Accession number 11939, rule 4.
Williams, Reel 4. As part of your training, Mr. Williams, how important figured the use of the bayonet?
Well, of course, I had the old 18-inch bayonet. The first thing we had to do with the bayonet, we knew it was there, we carried it on our hip and so on, and felt rather gay dogs carrying a bayonet on our... But the first thing we learned was that we had to fire part of our course with the bayonet fixed because of the weight of the bayonet pulled down the muzzle of the rifle, so you had to make allowance when you were firing it. So one part of the course you fired, we'll say, at 300 yards or 200 yards without a bayonet. Then you fixed bayonets and you fired with five rounds again, and you had to make dual allowance, as you learned, for the weight of the bayonet. We occasionally fixed bayonets, and we went through the motions of on guard, high port, on guard, and that sort of thing. But we never did any practice with sacks on. The first time I did that was when I was at, during the war, when I was at Hythe Wing Small Arms School training. So that effectively we knew the bayonet, but I remember one of the instructors, I think it was one of the regular instructors, telling us, remember that you must be able to use the bayonet. But the bayonet, and when your bayonet is fixed, make sure you hold it steady. And when you advance with the bayonet fixed, hold it steady, because the threat of the bayonet is in 99% cases more effective than the actual use of the bayonet. It's the threat which is valuable. And the threat involves in having nice shining bayonets which you can hold steady as you're advancing on him. As against that, we weren't allowed to shine our bayonets. The bayonets were kept oiled all the time. And many times I yearned to sort of get a bit of emery paper on and have a nice shiny bayonet like they had on the pictures and that sort of thing. But no, they were kept oiled. And we never had any, effectively, we had no bayonet practice. We knew it was there. There was also a bit of a tradition which was passed on to us about at one stage in the 1418 war, when some battalion or battalions of the Durhams were called Durham Gurkhas because of their effective use of the bayonet. And in our mind we thought, well, that means we're going to be able to use the bayonet when the time comes, you know. But we didn't have really much training.
You had old soldiers from the First World War in your units. What was the relationship between them and your young selves?
Yes. Well, in the company at Concert where I was, all the NCOs, all sergeants, and the sergeant major and the company sergeant major in the Territorial Army were First World War ribbons. And there was one corporal who was a First World War. There were a couple of rather drunken ordinary ranks with no rank at all who had also been First World men. And we used to look up to them, and we used to try and get them to talk. And when I look back now, a lot of the poor devils didn't want to talk because they'd had a belly full of it. But I remember one sergeant who, at one stage we used to have to pick the Lewis gun up and run forward and put it down and still our heaving breasts while we fired up the target, you know. And he used to get terribly excited and overwrought. And somebody, I couldn't understand, because he was a sergeant, he was an old man to me, it must have been about 40-ish, and I couldn't understand. Looking back from my own experience, I think he was still a little bit bomb-happy from the First World War. And when they used to hear the clatter of the machine gun, which the Lewis gun was, or the rifles, it used to set him on edge a little bit. That was the only case I noticed. And I remember once asking a man, why did Sergeant so-and-so get so uppity? Well, he was in France and he was in Mesopotamia. That seemed to be the explanation. So I thought, oh. I didn't realise, being green, not knowing anything about battle conditions and so on. But the others were if anything, slightly cynical. I remember on one occasion, we were going to have to, I think it was a camp, we were going to have to do some maneuver of some sort, and some of the older blokes complaining. I remember the company sergeant major with a very cynical look on his face. Never mind that, lads, think of the effing honour. With a grin on his face as an old soldier, which I'll always remember.
Did you have to dig trenches at any time in your training?
Never. I sometimes used to wonder about that, but they said that we couldn't dig trenches because we were digging on land and they wouldn't let us do it, you know. We were never at places. I think we once had one camp at Catrick where we were near some, but we never did any digging. We saw some trenches, but all our... We used to fire our course from trenches, prepared trenches, down at Whitburn and so on, but we never dug a trench. We never dug a trench at all.
Did you feel that your training overall was still linked to the First World War?
I should think totally, you know. I think somebody said that the British always fight the last war, or train for the last war, for any new war. I think we must have been training about the Napoleonic stage, you know. And we just were being taught to obey and keep us reasonably fit for a fortnight here. We could have all gone, if they didn't know this, we could have all gone and contracted AIDS and all sorts of things in the Latin remaining 50 weeks of the year, and they wouldn't have worried, but we had to be fit for the fortnight at camp. And I don't know, we just felt that's what being soldiers were. I think we rather thought we'd be lined up in a line and marched over the top, like the British soldiers that did the Somme, and like when Wellington said, stand up guards, and they advanced against Napoleon's forces. I think we're still imbued with that, you know.
At camp, you would be near a town with a red car or whatever. How did the civilians receive you for that fortnight?
Well, I think we never had any trouble at all with civilians. I know now, I didn't appreciate it then, but being a bit naive, it was a bit of a heyday for the local whores, you know, because you used to see some of these girls, they used to seem very friendly, you know. I wonder why they're so friendly, because they don't know me, you know. I must have been the world's biggest numbskull at that time, you know. There was a certain amount of that, and of course the pubs were open, but I don't remember. You see, it was a total Durham Light Infantry camp at the time. So there was no other regiment. There was no question of any regimental sort of antagonism creeping up, you see. And I think pubs were for the older men, or they went and got drunk there quite happily, and they had money to spend for the first time for some time, perhaps a lot of the poor devils who were unemployed, you know. And I think we were reasonably well received. We went to Catrick once. I don't think I saw any civilians when I was there, you know.
Can we come up towards the end of the 30s? You got your first stripe, I believe you said, around about the second.
Yeah, that would be about 1934. And then about 1935, I got my second stripe. And 36, and I think it would be about 37, I got my third stripe. Again, it was a bit hierarchical there, because there was a limit to the number of sergeants and NCOs in a company. It was only when somebody left, like one of the older, that there was a vacancy. And, you know, there used to be sort of whispers going on, there's a second stripe going. And everybody would sort of smarten themselves a bit more than usual and that sort of thing. And as I say, I got up to sergeant by 1937, which was 4 years after, 5 years after I joined, you know. And I think it was all that I decided that I'd honour my rank of sergeant by growing a moustache, you know. But I didn't feel as though any sense of ambition being thwarted or anything. I just thought, well, that's I suppose someday I might even be sergeant major. That time I hadn't considered the possibility of being commissioned, but I thought, well, if the war goes on, I might be sergeant major. If they have my service in, because, you see, I signed on... I signed on for 4 years, first of all. That took me up from 1932 to 1936. And then I signed on for 2 years. I think that was because I wasn't quite sure how my career, extraneous civilian career, was going. And then I was very happy, I signed on for 4 years again. But you could sign on for two. So I signed, and of course I was in the middle of signing on when the war started.
In your own company, Mr. Williams, did that prove any difficulties? I'm thinking particularly from the point of view of the envy of men who you were an equal rank with at one time.
I shouldn't think so, really. I wasn't conscious of it. There were a few people who sort of said, ah, lucky bugger, and that sort of thing, you know, but I don't think so. And the thing was this, when you were in the ranks, you knew what the Lance Corporal's duties were. So when you became a Lance Corporal, you knew that the men had to call you Corporal, or Lance Corporal, and you knew what he'd been doing, so you automatically overtook his duties. Very simple thing. When you were a corporal, you moved up a stage and you did the corporal's work, and you knew the men had to address you as corporal. And when you became a sergeant, you expected them to address you as sergeant, and you undertook the duties which you knew the sergeant had controlling you. So it was a comparatively simple thing. And the only thing, if there was a bit of a sergeant's mess, you know, which was a slightly separate thing. But no problem, really. I think there were one or two who must have been. I mean, it's no good being naive about these things. But you see, I didn't work with a lot of these lads. A lot of these lads were miners, or they worked in the works together and so on. And I was a clerk by myself, in the sense that I was the only clerk. There was another bloke. There were two of us at Consett who were territorials, in the Consett offices, who were territorials, you see. So we didn't get much chance to sort of compare. I really think that's all there is to it.
What were your duties as a Lance Corporal? What were the new duties?
Well, you inspected the section. You know, it was normally a section duty. You inspected their rifles, saw them clean on parade, checked them for their condition for parade, get your boots cleaned, and that sort of thing. And when you were at camp, you led a section. And, you know, you led them and signaled them to go in open order and charge up a hill or something. That was a case there when I must have been over-exuberant, because on one or two occasions I was checked for moving too fast and running too fast and getting the men out of breath. So they were so much out of breath that they couldn't hold their rifles and that sort of thing. It must have been enthusiasm on my part, you know. But that was all. And then when you were a corporal, you maybe looked at, assisted the sergeant. Sometimes you were just in charge of a section. Sometimes you were sort of second in command of the platoon sergeant, and you could carry on part of his duties. He might sort of say a thing like, you take those two sections off to the right, you know, when you were doing these manoeuvres at camp and that sort of thing. But...
Did you have guard duties?
Oh, yes, there were guards. And they had to get all blankoed up, full pack and everything. And there was a guards competition at camp. But I was never an NCO on a guard. I was a private soldier on a guard, but never an NCO. And I don't know why that was. I think perhaps there were some smarter and bigger men than I was, who probably looked better on parade, you know. But I think I was a bit peeved sometimes. I thought, well, I'm sure I could be as smart as him, you know. But I never was an NCO or sergeant or corporal on a guard.
And as a sergeant, what were your sergeant's duties in the company?
Well, I used to have to look after the men's records, see they were all right, and this was in the Territorial Army, of course, you're talking about. And you had very light duties. You inspected them and checked them and gave them talks about small arms drill and firing a rifle and fire and movement, the very simple sort of things that you'd read about in the Infantry Training Volume 1 and Volume 2, you know, that sort of thing. And in the platoon sergeant, you were responsible for seeing the platoon was falling in when the four platoons were falling in, and you handed over the sergeant major when you...
Were there proficiency awards other than just rifle shooting, which you
mentioned? No, there was just the shooting and a Lewis gun. There was a recruit's cup for general smartness, which I came second to my great chagrin. And after that, the only thing ever, I won the Lewis gun cup 1 year. which was just shooting, you know. But there wasn't anything else beyond that. But I remember there was this terrible innate snobbery. I remember the Sergeant Major sometimes, when he first introduced me, because I'd been a clerk, say, to the officer, very gentlemanly type of recruiter, you know. That was because I didn't work in the works and that sort of thing. It was the snobbery of those days, I suppose, we made him say that. But and after that, I was always referred to times, oh yes, very gentlemanly type, sir. He said, works in an office, you know, that sort of thing, you know.
As the war approached, did you feel that for the first time that as a territorial soldier you may be involved in danger?
Yes, I should. Well, I did say this, perhaps more so than some of my comrades, if you like. I was interested in politics. I told you when I was working in London, I used to go and listen to the speeches in the House of Commons and so on. And the village where I lived in Chopwell was a very left-wing place. It was known in the 1926 era as Little Moscow. And there were quite a lot of left-wing people. And I knew some of them. Two of the men whom I was very friendly with were killed in the Guadalajara River in the National Brigade. And I had a hatred of fascism and Germans. And I was quite convinced that someday we'd have to fight either Germans and Italians or not. Sure, I would have been quite happy because I thought I'd have been doing a meritorious job to shoot Germans and Italians. So I had no qualms at all. This probably sounds terribly naive and terribly sort of, but I didn't have any qualms whatsoever in contemplation of the possibility. I knew that men of the Dermot Infantry had given a good account of themselves in the 1418 War and the Boer War and so on. Some of our old wartime sergeants, when they give you instructions, they didn't talk about the enemy, they talked about the Germans. Now the Germans are supposed to be on that hill, they were supposed to say enemy. They might have been Arabs or anything, but they were always Germans. And I had a preconceived, my mind was prepared, and I had no qualms whatsoever at the idea of having to go and shoot Germans.
Did you feel that this attitude of the Germans as the enemy had run right through the 20s and 30s?
It did with me, but I think perhaps I was, I used to read an awful lot, you know. And first of all, I didn't like Germans. My uncle used to tell me some of the things the Germans used to do in the 1418 War. Sometimes he said they were quite decent people. But I'd formed an opinion that decent Germans were so far in between that you could discount that. And then when I saw the growth of Nazism, and I was reading, I remember there was a friend of mine, there was a sort of book club called the Left Book Club, which used to produce books and with yellow backs. Gallants. Published them at cheap rate. This friend of mine used to lend me them, and they all used to be on it. They were very left-wing, without any doubt. And the strange thing was, I had no sort of socialist or left-wing sort of leanings, but I had very anti-fascist feelings in me. And the Germans were beginning to equate themselves as fascists. And general opinion, there was another friend of mine I spoke to once, said, well, these bloody Germans, fascists, call them what you like. Prussians, they're all the same. The sooner you get rid of them, the better, you know.
As the war years came, were there any changes in either the way you were training or the weapons that you were
yes.
training with or receiving?
Well, not in the weapons, but we... in the weapons of what? First of all, we started marching in threes instead of forming fours.
And what was the advantage of that?
I just don't... I think it was because... You needed fewer men for a platoon, you know, when you had four men and in Iraq and three men, and I suppose it was more manoeuvrable in a way. But we still had four companies in the battalion, although we had three, we formed threes. And then we gradually, the Lewis gun was gradually, very slowly, filtered out, and we got the Bren gun. And we really thought we were moving into modern sort of arms, you know. If I can digress, my wife's grandfather was a regular soldier in the 89th Regiment of Foot, and he was in the Crimean War. And when he landed in Crimea, they still had the Brown Bess muskets, which Waterloo had been won by. and the gradually got a rifle, breech loading rifle, and filled it in. And I think the thought that the end of the world was coming down. They were quite prepared to spit bullets in the home run, plug them in and so on. And when we began to get angry, we thought, well, really? And then we saw a Bren gun carrier, you know. And we really thought that was harmless. Didn't realise that a hit square on by a 303 bullet would go right through the armour. It's only if it was glanced off that you could get away with it. But we really thought we were going to be invincible with that sort of thing, you know. And I think there was no fall away, strange enough. We didn't have people who said, oh God, I'm not going to join the territory. We were always up to strength. And the Daily Telegraph used to give a cup for the highest strength battalion. 6th Battalion won it several times, you know. Because there were almost plenty. It's an anomalous situation. You had people here living under direst conditions, unemployed, miners working under very harsh conditions for a very small amount of money, hard-working steel workers and so on, that was throughout County Durham. And you had these people who were quite prepared to join a territorial army. They're people that had some very hard times in the 1418 war, yet they were still there. And I know in my particular case, I was almost fanatically for king and country, you know. There it is.
As the war came very much closer, there were changes, were there not, with the concert company?
Yes. During 1938, the concert company became an anti-aircraft battery. I think that was because when you got some of the companies at places like Crook and so on, they drew from a very wide area. But concert, you had from the Black Hill and Leadgate and sort of area around here. It was a very compact sort of company. And although it wasn't entered in my record, temporarily, I became a Lance Sergeant in the Royal Artillery. And we had a predictor. That was one of these things where you turned little wheels in order to predict the height and speed of the aircraft and so on. We didn't see any guns at that stage. But I remember sitting working in a predictor and thinking one day, Williams, what the hell are you doing here? You're a soldier, you're not an artillery, you're not an anti-aircraft man. You're an infantry soldier. So I went to the Chopwell drill hall and saw the Sergeant Major there, whom I didn't know before. I introduced myself. I said, I was a sergeant in the 6th Battalion, and now we've turned into an anti-aircraft battery, and I want to be a soldier again. Can you do anything for me? And he said, well, the Yazin will be up tomorrow night. Come along and see him. This bloke was, now there was, he was a Sergeant Major, but he was permanently in charge of a drill hall. He wasn't a regular, he was a territorial, but he was in charge of the drill hall. It was a job, you know. And the adjutant came along with Captain Sammy Battiscombe. And I explained to him, I said, I don't think basically I'm an artilleryman, sir. I'm an infantryman. And I'd very much appreciate if I could possibly transfer here. I'm not worried about rank. I'm a sergeant. I was a sergeant in the 6th Battalion, but I'm not worried about rank as long as I can get here. He said, I think we'll try and do something for you, Williams. And he came up, I had to go to the next drill, and that was on the Thursday, and he came and said, you can join the battalion as a sergeant. We have a vacancy. We're very pleased to have you.
And this was the 9th Battalion?
9th Battalion. So I was issued. I came up here, and I resigned from up here. You could still resign. But, and I went there, and I was presented with got a uniform with brass buttons for the first time in my life. But I went home and nearly polished them to death. First time I'd been a real sparkling sort of infantry soldier. When I came down the hatch and said, doesn't he look a smart sergeant, Sergeant Major? I think they use a bull, you know. And that was how I joined the 9th Battalion. Now that was in the beginning of 1939, early years of 1939. So I was all ready for August the 25th when I was called up.
Were there any other changes early in 1939 as the war was imminent?
Well, you remember there were young soldiers, I think they were 19 or 20, were called up into what was called the militia. They were conscripted into the army. So you had a regular army, you had these militia who were young men who had been literally conscripted, and the territorial army. And then someone, law was passed, which said that any young soldier who didn't want to go into militia, he could join the Territorial Army and serve in the Territorial Army. So we had a rush of 19 and 20 year olds who didn't want to leave home at that particular time, you know. And we got them there, you see. And that was about all, you know, really.
You weren't involved in the doubling up in strength of the battalion and the high...
No. Later on, there was... we formed two companies by recruiting and so on. We had the 9th Battalion Band, and bugles up marching through concert, through Chopwell, recruiting. Those who wanted could then go to the drill hall and sign on. And a number did, actually. There weren't militiamen, and there weren't any potential militiamen. It was just ordinary people went. And we got two companies. And the second company was used... We transferred to the Tyneside Scottish Battalion.
And you escaped this?
I was in the first company.
Obviously, the danger of war was very apparent now. What were your parents' feelings now, thinking that while you're a territorial soldier and you may at any time become a permanent one?
Well, my mother was worried. But strangely enough, my mother said, "I don't like the idea of those sergeant and officers shouting at you." She didn't take into account that I was doing a bit of shouting myself, you know. My father didn't have much to say. I think he realised it was that I was already in. And after all, by 1939, I was 26. So I was a man in my own right, you know. But we began to get a few lectures by regular officers about firepower and about manoeuvre and tactics and that sort of thing. And then in the latter months before, we were given a series of code words. Code words, I forget what it was now. If that was given to you on the telephone from headquarters, you called up key personnel, which was a small number of people who went and saw that all the rifles were ready and everything was ready, in anticipation of a call-up. Now, I was sergeant on key personnel. And I can well remember, I was playing darts with the sergeant major after drill, and the telephone rang. I said, "Leave those darts alone. Don't you start moving these around while I answer the telephone." Because he said, "Gunner," answered, and it was Captain Battiscombe, and he gave me the code word. He said, "Who's that?" I said, "Sergeant Williams here, sir." He said, "Would you repeat that so you got it?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Know what that means?" I said, "Yes, sir." I said, "Okay." Put it into effect. And I went back to Sergeant Major and said, "Key personnel call up." We said, like Drake, he said, "We'll finish this dart game, then we'll gamble and get the lads."
What date was this?
25th. August. It was the night of the 24th, actually, because I was called up on the 25th. I can verify that day precisely because my father and mother were away at some small boarding house in Tynemouth, and I sent them a telegram. I've got a copy of the telegram now, which says called up, and the date on the stamp is 25th of August. And we had to go around and get the other members of the key personnel in, you know, just what it said. "Come on, Geordie, we're called up." I remember went to one chap. He came to the door with his sort of pitch shirt on and his bare feet. He'd just come out of the tin bath. And I said, "George, key personnel call up." He said, "Does that mean I didn't have to go into work?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Bloody good show. I don't know." He got his equipment, got his uniform, and then came along. We went around. There were about 12 of us were called up on this key personnel.
And your job was to get things ready for
get you. Things ready. See the rifles and everything were oiled and see... Everybody knew what was what and who, you know, and all documentation up to date and that sort of thing. And that was the 25th, and then on the 1st of September, the Territorial Army was mobilised, or embodied, as though we were a bunch of spirits or something, you know.
What were your personal feelings at that time? The show was starting now. What was your personal feelings?
Just, this is it. Please, let me be a good soldier and not be too frightened. I think that was about all, with a little bit of excitement, because I'd been a clerk for so long and so on, and now I was going to be a real soldier. I'd always wanted to be a soldier. Now I was going to be a real soldier, and that was going to be my life or my death, one way or another. And I just wanted to make quite sure I was a good lad infantryman and didn't let the side down, speaking general terms.
Did you have any thoughts as to how long it might last? It wouldn't be over by Christmas kind of thing?
No, nothing at all, lad. I thought this was going to be a war, you know? Because I knew the Germans were a strong people. I mean, We'd listen to all the rantings of Hitler and Mussolini on the radio, you know, and that sort of thing. We'd listen to on the radio, we'd heard the marching of innumerable feet as the stormtroopers and the SS and so on were marching. We knew it wasn't going to be an easy job. The only inquiry I made at the time was, I forget for whom I inquired, how do I ensure that my mother gets the best possible pension if anything happens to me? And he said, well, normally the army will base its pension for your next of kin on how much allocation you've made. Well, at that time, I was a sergeant on 6 shillings a day, so I allocated 3 shillings to my mother to make sure she got a good pension in the afternoon.